hppodcraft.com.
Hello, ghoul friends. This is Chad Pfeiffer here at HP Podcraft.
And I'm Chris Lackey. We're conducting strange studies of strange stories.
Today, we're solving the mystery of what you thought about our October shows, Mystery Authors Doing Weird Fiction. It's the comments show. Let's plunge in. We're starting with The Hound of Death. Clint Page writes, "What a great story. Felt like a lost Universal horror movie." Man, that's exactly the thought I had when I started reading that.
Mark Saunders writes, "Love this story in this episode. In answer to Chad's question, there are many films and TV shows about Christie's disappearance. There's a film from 1979 called Agatha with Vanessa Redgrave and Dustin Hoffman. Greg Johnson was actually telling me about this. He said when he was listening to the show, because he lived in Harrogate and it was shot in Harrogate, so he recognizes all the locations that it was shot in. So he was like, no." Mark goes on to say, "More importantly, it was the subject of an episode of Doctor Who with David Tennant called The Unicorn and the Wasp."
Oh.
Don't remember that one.
I mean, that story is just too good. There was no way it hasn't been adapted. So.
Yeah.
I wonder what the Doctor Who episode was like.
I don't remember that one. I'd have to go back and look at it.
But Doctor Who often, I don't watch that show very much, but it often will take something historical and then use Doctor Who to explain it, right?
Yeah, they've been doing a better job with that, where the Doctor is somehow involved, but still doesn't take agency away from the actual people that did the things.
That's interesting. I should give that show a try. There's only like one season of it, right? I could probably binge that in a week.
Sure, yeah. I'll give it a shot. Josh Miller writes, "Loving the big budget guest, guys. Very impressive. I knew this podcast was incredibly popular worldwide, but I didn't realize it was Steven Spielberg popular. Congratulations again on the get."
I'd like to take credit for that, but we didn't have much to do with it.
No.
He just jumped in. He broke into our Twitter feed last week as well, talking about how Boondock Saints is the best movie ever. Weird opinion. I never would have guessed. Well, that movie's terrible, but... I thought it was maybe a prank. I got in touch with Twitter. They said, no, you know, that's Steven Spielberg. It's a problem we have with him. Well, he's got really advanced CGI. You can basically do whatever he wants. He uses his CGI to break into Twitter. He got my neighbor's dog high somehow. So that's what we're dealing with. He might show up. It's really, like I say, it's not up to us.
You know, CGI stands for computer generated image.
I don't know. He uses it. Shana Carter writes, "I wonder if Dr. Rose's name, his occult studies, and Sister Marie Angelique's statement that he is of the Brotherhood are clues that he's a Rosicrucian. According to Agatha Christie's Wikipedia entry, some of her earliest writing was inspired by an interest in spiritualism and the paranormal, so I'd assume she had some knowledge of the esoteric orders and secret societies that grew out of Rosicrucianism. One of them, the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn, was especially well known and included among its acknowledged or suspected members, such luminaries as Arthur Machen, Arthur Conan Doyle, and the self-proclaimed wickedest man in the world, ceremonial magician Aleister Crowley. Anyway, thanks for introducing me to this story. I'll definitely check out Christie's other forays into weird fiction."
Cool stuff. I didn't realize that. Nom Nom Daguerre writes, "For some reason, I was worried you guys were going to bail on the Spielberg bit."
I wonder if you were worried again when I started talking about Rosicrucianism instead of continuing to talk about Spielberg's CGI abilities. I don't understand them. I don't know how he uses it that way. That's just what Twitter told me. Patrick Lackey writes, "Spielberg..."
That's my brother.
Patrick Lackey's your brother?
Yep.
Oh, man, all this time. I didn't even realize. Yeah, Lackey. Now it makes sense. "Spielberg sounds kind of like Morty. Maybe you're getting pranked by Justin Roiland." It's possible.
Interesting theory.
Yeah.
Steve writes, "The story is redolent with other metaphysical authors such as C.S. Lewis and Charles Williams. In particular, Williams' many dimensions about a magical stone and Lewis's space trilogy, rather than Narnia, both were writing modernist Christian fantasies and science fiction with a millennialist bent."
Ethan Cordray writes, "I imagine it's beyond this podcast purview, but both of the latter two volumes of Lewis's space trilogy contain what seem to be extremely specific Lovecraftian cosmic horror beats. Lewis employs these toward an anti-Lovecraftian effect, going on to show how cosmic horror could be integrated into an optimistic Christian cosmological view. But in the moments in which they occur, they read like things straight out of Lovecraft, particularly the subterranean ant monster and Perelandra and the descent of Saturn in That Hideous Strength. It's made me wonder whether Lewis ever actually read HPL. I don't know how available Weird Tales was in England at the time. Or whether he was just pulling from related British weird fiction writers like Machen, Blackwood, and Hodgson. Personally, I got into Lovecraft in college at the same time that I was reading Lewis and other Inklings in literature classes, so that connection was strong for me." I never read much C.S. Lewis.
I read The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, and I think that was it. I never got into it to the point that I wanted to read any of the other books. Maybe I started... Was it Prince Caspian? Was that the second book? I think I started to read the second book and just didn't care and gave up on it.
Good enough for me. Yeah. Screw that guy. Terrible author. I say that on Chris's authority.
Andrew Lehman writes, is Anne Struthers related to Sally Struthers? Yes, she is.
Yeah. Well, hey, see? Now, the reason that's a funny joke is because clearly Anne Struthers is not related to Sally Struthers. So don't make fun of me for not knowing Patrick Blackie was your brother.
True.
I just know him as a gambling man.
Yeah.
I know him as an honorable man.
Yeah.
I don't know where I was going with this when I started it. It sounds like I'm like going to break down, doesn't it? I know that he's honest and true to his word. God damn you, Patrick. Why'd you have to be so good?
John Hancock writes, excellent work managing to link Agatha Christie's work to the Manimalverse. Very appropriate for Hawktober. No?
Whoa.
Ah, well, suit yourselves.
Hawktober's pretty great.
Hawktober's pretty great, yeah.
I would do, for that month, I would do movies featuring the actor John Hawks, because he used to live upstairs from me.
All right. Carlandos writes, when I think of Agatha Christie, I don't usually think of heavy metal. That said, if Blasted Heath is still playing, then Hound of Death should be your next album.
Anything of death is going to sound metal. Mad Lib. Could do that all day long. Episode 519, The Call of Wings. Sanjay Matthew writes, I hate to comment adversely on the silken-voiced Andrew Lehman's dramatic choices, but it's unlikely that an East End parson in the 1930s would actually be an East Ender, as per the accent choice in the opening reading. Dick Barrow, like most Church of England clerics, would likely have been from a solidly middle class, definitely university-educated background, and would be unlikely to have a Cockney-esque accent. Stereotypically, the inner-city parsons were among the more dedicated of the Church of England's personnel, choosing to work among the poor rather than trying for a richer and more comfortable parish. In fact, in some more obscure early 20th century English weird fiction, you do occasionally have the trope of a worn-out inner-city vicar taking a holiday by serving as the locum to a soft rural or suburban parish. This, incidentally, is why Barrow talks about a vision driving him. You'd have to be pretty idealistic to do the work he does, when as a Church of England man, there would be the possibility of easier billets. In the early 20th century, Anglican equivalent of being a social worker. If anything, it's the self-made Silas Hamer who'd be more likely to sound like an East Ender. So true. I apologize for this tiny quibble. I love Andrew's work. His voice plays upon my ears like the piping of the flutes of the outer gods. And he's absolutely right about those choices. And I wrote back, Andrew often gets the selections out of context, which was the case this time. And that was my direction. You know, I'll say a couple lines like, this guy's like this, or do this like that. And then I said, because it doesn't specify in the background, that's what I chose. See, it was so defensive. That was my choice, when the fact is it was just laziness. he's right. But it wasn't Andrew's fault. The quibble is the correct quibble.
Yeah.
And that does make sense. Usually a social worker is not actually going to be of the environment they choose to work in.
Super great insight, Sanjay. Wonderful stuff. Yeah. Thank you so much. Monster Talk writes, why would Pan help out a Christian narrative? Because it behooved him to do so.
Nice.
Remember, because he lost his legs?
Yes.
In the story?
Yes.
I like it.
I do too.
Ethan Cordry writes, well said, but perhaps to elaborate, the classic symbology of the satyr associates the goat legs with animal appetites, primarily sexual. For Pan, or the satyr, to remove his own legs and call them evil would signify discarding the animal nature for the purely spiritual, transcendent, / ecstatic desire expressed by the music. Nietzsche labeled this split the Dionysian versus Apollonian tendencies of art, specifically thinking of 19th century art had gone too far towards Apollo and needed a reintroduction of Dionysus. Music is interestingly associated with both physical / sexual frenzy and intellectual / abstract ecstasy. In the case of this story, though, the minimalist and the indescribable ascent of the music put it completely in the realm of the Apollonian transcendental. Just what you'd expect from a Pan who'd abjured his own goaty legs.
That's the tension in all art, I think, is the tendency toward the cerebral and lofty versus the grounded and realistic and carnal.
Mm-hmm.
Sex is realism, and then there's gods in the heavens and the aspirational stuff. And yeah, I thought the story was all about that, and so it was really cool. Monster Talk writes, regarding music and Dionysus, that is a recurrent theme in Peter Bebergal's book Season of the Witch. Don't know if I pronounced the author's name right. Bebergal. It's a deep dive into the history of rock music's relationship, both real and folkloric, to the occult. It's a really interesting book. Yeah, it does sound good. Bebergal suggests that Dionysus is the patron deity of rock symbolically, but occasionally with deliberate intention. The thing about Dionysus is that while Macken described seeing Pan as driving one mad, in the Greek myths, the tale of Dionysus and Pentheus is one of the most Lovecraftian damn stories ever. And we know Lovecraft loved the Greek myths, so he had to be aware of it. I'm not going to attempt to retell it here because I can't do it justice myself, and Patreon comments UI is not conducive to it, but it's chilling AF, so folks look that up, Dionysus and Pentheus. But within this story, I was also reminded of the Plutarch story of the sailor being told the great god Pan is dead. That story was probably in Agatha Christie's awareness. It's poetically inspired a lot of writing, and I assume is why Mackin titled his famous story thusly. I think I first became aware of this Pan is dead idea from the band The Waterboys. They have a song called The Return of Pan from the early 90s. Also, when you've given away your wealth and materialist habits, all you've left is change.
Yeah, true. Stuart Huntsman writes, thanks for covering this, guys. I thoroughly enjoyed hearing this story analyzed and helping me understand a story whose weirdness has always confused and intrigued me. I especially enjoyed Chad's tangent on minimalism. Listening to this, it occurred to me that even when Pan is apparently more benevolent, no one seems to survive an encounter with him. And he often seems to be the key of some sort of ascension, whether for good or for ill, usually the latter. There's something a little unnerving about Pan in this, because he still serves as a lure into something almost unknowable. And I think it's only because Silas is rising that it feels beneficent.
Pan is the reminder that you're going to die. I think the aspirational stuff, you know, the carnal and the human and the realism reminds you of just the gritty reality of the world, right? And then there's the tension with the ethereal. Andrew Lehman writes, I too greatly enjoyed Chad's tangent on minimalism and found it rather moving. I look forward to the next tangent on manimalism. There's some good jokes coming in on this comment show. I Andrew. Like it a lot.
Joe Hodgson writes, you both need a weighted blanket in your life. I sleep so much better since getting one. Yeah, it sounds good. Steve writes, proprioception is about knowing where your body and limbs are in relation to each other.
Oh, yeah, that's right. You brought that up.
Yes, because I was talking, I couldn't remember that sense because we have more than the five senses. Have you been reading Temple Grandin on cows? The reason I brought up the cows is because cows get stressed out and their milk doesn't get great. And one of the things they found that makes cows feel better is squeezing them.
Well, it must be something Temple Grandin wrote about. Well, by the way, I didn't miss that Joe Hodgson was pitching that weighted blanket pretty hard.
Yeah.
I sleep so much better since getting one. You should try mine. It's only 200 pounds. You know, I see that he's working in. The Screaming Moist writes, regarding the death and mortality discussion, I lost my dad unexpectedly back in August. I'm sorry to hear that. And the question of circumstance is such a weird one. He went peacefully in his sleep, which in a lot of ways has made the process easier. But on the other hand, nothing drives home the reality of your own mortality quite like having a conversation with someone, then getting a call 5 hours later that they're dead. No accident or trauma or outside force, just dead. Still not sure if that means we shouldn't worry because it's entirely out of our control or if we should just be worried all the time. I guess some combination of both, man.
Yeah.
I mean, the truth is we shouldn't worry at all, but I just don't think that's possible.
No.
You know,
we fluctuate between those two states and you shouldn't worry about it because it is out of your control. But as humans, we can't help but want to worry about things and control things and make sure that we're doing all the things we're supposed to do and going to the doctor and exercising and eating right and you know, not taking lots of cocaine all the time. And hopefully those things will help us out. But sometimes you just got to cut loose, you know, man. You just got to let it rip because we're not going to be here forever. Life is finite. There's no getting around that, period.
You call it strippers and blow. I call it self-care.
Exactly. William Reeder writes, artists talk a lot about freedom. So recalling the expression free as a bird, Morton Feldman went to the park one day and spent some time watching our feathered friends. When he came back, he said, you know, they're not free. They're fighting over bits of food. And that was written by John Cage as a quote.
You were talking about that notion of poor people being free somehow because they're all out laying around in the park in that story. And that quote directly addresses that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Are birds free? It looks like. Looks like they got some kind of miserable lives out there.
Yep.
Shana Carter writes, while reading The Call of Wings, I kept bracing for turns that the story didn't take. Hammer's sensations of floating or rising led me to expect that he was going to share the fate of Barzai from Lovecraft's The Other Gods and fall into the sky. Later, when Hammer describes dreams of great stretches of reddish sand, and here and there straight, long lines of water like canals, and Seldom mused, surely the materialist, the man who loved the flesh and denied the spirit, was the last man to see the sights of another world. I thought they were referring to the planet Mars. However, on reflection, I wonder if Hammer wasn't seeing the city of Sister Marie Angelique's visions in The Hound of Death.
Mm.
Oh, that's cool if there's a connection there. I did totally call Pan's amputation of his legs because as nonchalant they were evil reminded me of the one-armed man in Twin Peaks, mm-hmm. who declares, "When I saw the face of God, I was changed. I took the entire arm off." Well, that's true. There's that beat in Twin Peaks. How cool. That gets us into the Leopard Lady.
Jennifer DeFord writes, "I'm so excited you're covering Sayers. I'm also ashamed that in the many years since I first read this story, it never occurred to me that it might be supernatural. Even a tiny bit. What a failure of imagination on my part.
You fool."
I agree with Chad that I would have liked to see Lord Peter take a crack at this. And another short story, he does something similar, pretending to be a wizard in order to get access to someone.
We've all done it.
Yeah.
We've all done it. Sanjay Matthew writes, "Holy crap, I had no idea that Dorothy Sayers came up with the Guinness toucan. As an enthusiast of both Guinness and weird fiction, I shall raise a glass to her the next time I have one." Lord Rancid follows up, "To be fair, she didn't come up with the toucan, just the advertising slogans. An illustrator called John Gilroy designed the bird, though his first idea was a sea lion balancing a pint on its nose. A whole menagerie of animals followed for the ad campaign, of which the toucan was just one."
Mm.
And to my point in that episode, you know, they didn't know what would work at the time, so they would just throw animals at these advertisements until something stuck, just like the space program.
Yep. Rafe Ball writes, "Chad referring to Smith & Smith as a pop-up shop. Maybe picture some trendy pop-up staffed by hipster assassins. Welcome to Humford & Sons, Contract Killings. Would sir care for a decaf soy latte whilst you peruse our offering?"
Nice. Esteban Barbero writes, "Wow, that's a very grim tale. I think the worst part, besides the child murder, of course, is the casualness of how they discuss what they're going to do. Regardless of whether there is a supernatural element or not, they are all psychopaths."
Yeah.
He's talking about the story, right?
Shana Carter writes, "Although Chris was skeptical that Smith & Smith can operate as a non-magical entity, this concept of an invisible yet ubiquitous and near omniscient network has precedence. Think of Arthur Conan Doyle's Professor Moriarty, the silent film serial Les Vampires, or Fritz Lang's crime dramas involving the criminal mastermind Dr. Mabuse. It just seems, I mean, come on, how did she get the freaking leopards into that neighbor's house? Where do they get leopards?"
They talked to that animal handler in the Saki story that we're covering.
That makes sense.
Sean McGivern writes, "I think we could describe the illustrious party at the start as featuring the creme de la crème."
Ooh, okay, I like that.
Yes.
Michael Cunliffe writes, "Where did they get the leopard? Ah, see, that's what I just said. I think we finally discovered what Manimal's grandpa got up to. There we are.
Aha, Manimalism. When you apply it to most things, it works.
Just tying it all together.
On our comments show, there was only really one on there where Steve wrote Basil. It's Basil, if you're posh. And yeah, you know, it's just hard. Americans, it's a seasoning to us. It's not a common name here. So
we're
going to say Basil once in a while. I think we made that mistake quite a bit. But we know better. It's Basil. Just how it comes out, you know? Cole Karen writes, "Haven't listened to the episode yet, so I'm going to assume this comment, the Basil comment, is about pesto." Mm-hmm. See, you go right to that basil, pesto, food. It's a tough one to say, right?
Yes.
Getting us into episode 521, The Cyprian Cat.
Yeah, Michael Cunliffe writes, "Pooka is of Celtic origin, a mischievous shape changer that turns from person to animal like a trickster of many other cultures. And pucker is the English word for genuine, proper, or good. Best said with a broad Cockney accent and or slang." Jeez, Terry. That's a pucka cuppa rosy.
There you go.
It's really bad at accents. I've been trying to do a Yorkshire. I've lived here for 10 years. I still can't do a Yorkshire accent. I was watching videos about Yorkshire accents, trying to get it. And I thought I had. I went up and talked to Rachel and I said, "Hey," and I said it. She goes, "Is that supposed to be Scottish?"
She just takes you to the hospital.
I can't do it.
I don't like what he's doing. It's weird and I don't understand it.
I live in Keithley. Michael goes on to say, "There's also a brand of pies you'll find in most English chip shops and supermarkets called pucker pies."
Jake Wilson writes, "Adopted into English, but as Chad suspected, via India. From Hindi and Urdu, it means ripe or fully cooked and is used figuratively to mean fully formed, permanent, or sure. So it's a short jump to the English use to mean something proper or good."
Hmm.
I can imagine Rachel saying it in a Yorkshire accent and Chris not being able to pronounce it. But I'm confident any American can manage the word because it rhymes with Samuel L. Jackson's catchphrase and also with trucker.
Yeah, but I think they drop the R when they're English, so they say pucka.
Yeah, there's no R on the word.
No.
They actually might add the R. Who knows? English are crazy.
They're all nuts.
They don't speak it right.
Alexander Lyle writes, "I really like the words that come to English from India. You get ones that you can spot, like pucka, but then you get the ones that we just use every day, like pundit and pajamas." Oh, didn't realize
also something I wear every day, pajamas.
Yeah.
Last time I had to travel, I realized that the equation's all off in my wardrobe. It's like 80% pajamas and 20% real clothes these days. John Hazard writes, "You're joking about the He-Man fanfic, right? Seriously, Manimal is okay, but Masters of the Universe is too much." And that sentiment was echoed around the internet. Really scared some people, which I think is awesome. Just when you thought we couldn't scare you anymore.
Yeah, we're still offering the terror.
Fear finds a way.
Chargo Fullard writes, "You know, there's a bit of precedent for cats flocking to people that dislike them, actually. More accurately, they can be more affectionate to strangers that ignore them. For what I understand, cats tend to interpret close attention as caution. If some strange animal is paying close attention to them, staring, making weird sounds and movements at them, because they're concerned that cat may be a threat and they are ready to defend themselves. And that's how it works if a new cat is acting that way to them after all. As such, a person ignoring them or looking at them with other signs of ease, like half-lidded eyes, cats don't recognize the expression of squinting, or making the body small by slumping in your seat or recoiling away from them, are things that make a new cat potentially think that you're indifferent to their presence. You aren't considering them a threat, so they don't need to consider you one either."
That's exactly right.
Totally cool. I didn't know that.
Cats are super territorial. So if you're going, "Hey, look at you," and you're coming in and you're grabbing at them and stuff, they're like, "What's going on? Got to get, a, you know, yeah. have to assess this." And they often, if you see a cat close its eyes around you, that's like a expression of affection. Oh. They're not worried. You're going to hurt them. John Hancock writes, "Remember the Manly Wade Wellman story, Oh Ugly Bird? Of course I do. The connection between the cat and the woman reminded me very much of that between Mr. Anselm and the ugly bird. Which leads me to think that the clueless protagonist of this tale would have done better to have left the pistol alone and just swatted the cat with a guitar." Always the better choice.
Alexandra Showell writes, "Concerning the mark on the wife's chest, while it could easily just be an awkward attempt at foreshadowing or the fumbling attempt of an unreliable narrator to take the blame off of himself, there is an interesting third possibility. Back during the witch hunts and Inquisition, the chief task of the Inquisitor was to find proof of the accused pact with the devil. This proof came in the form of some kind of dark mark on the witch's body. They would claim anything, a scar, a large birthmark, an odd shadow, dirt, and even, yes, a mole. So perhaps this was meant to be more proof to the reader that the woman was indeed a supernatural creature. Or maybe I'm talking crazy and our narrator is just a perv." That's a totally great insight. I'm a little ashamed that we didn't say that.
H.R. Price says, "Just dropping by to make sure someone brings up witch marks." "Conspicuous moles or marks on the skin or witches that were supposedly nipples at which familiars would feed. I assume that's what the mole was invoking. Thanks, guys. We're idiots." Bryce Perry writes, "So yes, Felice is the feminine form of Felix, but Felix the cat is itself a bit of wordplay. Felix is Latin for lucky, and Felix the cat is a black cat, traditionally an unlucky animal to cross." So yeah, she stole something that was even cleverer than I thought. John Hancock writes, "Although that depends where you're from, black cats are considered lucky in many places outside America." I didn't know that.
Sanjay Matthew writes, "I also just assumed Felix and Felice also echoed feline."
Yep,
all works.
It's a great choice to steal. Shana Carter writes, "Felice obviously wasn't transforming into a cat, since the narrator and Mr. Meridew perform a whole Three Stooges routine with their senseless body slapping her with those towels.
Yeah.
While the Cyprian cat is howling on a windowsill. So, was her consciousness possessing a cat or taking the form of a cat? I'm guessing the latter, since the only corpse found after the shooting was that of Felice. In which case, what's the deal with all the other cats in the story? Are the little Ginger, the stinking Black Tom, and the white kitten real cats, somehow drawn to the Cyprian? Or is little Hexham a popular destination for out-of-body experiences?"
They could all be witches, and maybe they were having a witches' congress, and that's what that was all about. Or, maybe other cats were drawn to her. Is that something we talked about at the end of that, where if he shot the cat was outside of her body, if we remember?
Yeah, I didn't know why it had an impact on her, but it was that profound spiritual connection, kind of like, you know, Freddy kills you in your sleep, you die in real life kind of thing.
Exactly, yeah. Evan writes, "Regarding the eye poking thing, testing the corneal reflex, what I'm making the assumption this is a way to see if comatose or vegetative patients experience brain death. Essentially, if someone touches your eye when you're not consciously controlling for it, you will blink. If you don't, it means that there's pretty serious nerve damage and that you're dead. It's similar to pupillary reflex, where as long as you're alive, your pupils should adjust to different amounts of light and expand and contract. Eyes are the window to the soul, or in this case, whether or not your soul is still in your body."
Yeah, so there is, I guess, some medical basis for touching someone's eyeball. Darn it. It was much funnier when I didn't think there was. Peter Larson writes, ugh, can't stand stories where cats are killed. I mean, I get it, but please, no more dead cats. I mean, we're not choosing on that criteria. No. It just keeps happening. We will do some animal revenge stories this year. I promise. I've been thinking about doing that for a while, just to get karma back in our favor.
Well, technically, there's no dead cat in that story.
Ooh.
Yeah.
You chilled me all over again.
Put that in your pipe and smoke it. Thomas Painter writes, regarding Gritty Murder, She Wrote, the whole classic murder mystery genre is a bit odd. How many murders are there that involve complex plots, inheritance, etc., among genteel people, as opposed to clumsy domestic or drug deal gone bad murders? Why do we have a vast body of literature about what must be a rare type of crime? That's a good point.
Because it exists in fake fiction world, I think.
Yeah.
Which is why it's not totally depressing. Like, I wasn't kidding. I mean, Murder, She Wrote's kind of a lighthearted show. If you think about what it's really about, it's like, whoa.
I think we talked about it before. There's that great This American Life where they talk about murder and how, for some reason, our culture is okay with murder, you know, to the point of we have how to host a murder parties. But if it was something else, like a rape, you don't have a how to host a rape party. There's something about desensitizing towards murder. Like, it's not such a bad thing. Obviously, it is if you experience. And people that have experienced the murder of a loved one don't find, you know, how to host a murder parties necessarily as much fun.
I struggle. Yeah, it's... I can understand why people like these things, the true crime stuff. You know, it's, you want to know what's out there, and there's a certain, it's the reason you read horror. It's in that same field. It gives you a sense of your own vulnerability and your own mortality and a way to sort of control the randomness and horror of the world. Mm-hmm. But it does, since I'm not in that kind of thing, every once in a while, since I do podcasts, people go, oh, I love podcasts. And then they rattle off three or four and they're all about murder. You know, they're like, I like, you know, murderinos. I like murder up the wazoo. I mean, everything is murder something. I go, oh, okay. Well, you know, that's a specific genre, I guess. You like a lot of that, huh? Sometimes leads to some uncomfortable conversations, I guess. You know, I go, so you're into that? Well, no, I'm not into the murder. It's just they're really good. You've got a hat that says murder on it. Yeah, well, I was supporting their Patreon. And
well, you know, it's drama. It's one of those things that we're all going to have to deal with. Again, I said this earlier.
Murder?
We're all going to die. Not necessarily murder, but we're all going to die. And our mortality is something, you know, all of us are grappling with that. I think somehow, by listening to murder stories and watching horror films and doing these things, we're somehow working through that.
Oh, totally. And I also think that it just gives you control over it, because if you can construct a real life event into a story, it gives you a sense of power over it. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that's why conspiracy theories start, etc. But topic for another show. Bonus episode 30, We Bleed Orange and Black.
Yes.
Which is a book by Jeff C. Carter. Fought his way onto the show triumphantly with this one, I thought. Yeah. Jim Bassett writes, this was really fun. Thanks. I especially liked Inky's Day Out and played it for wife and son while we had dinner tonight on Halloween. The image of Inky being mobile inside a pumpkin is priceless. But what really made me laugh with joy was how Inky indicated he wanted to continue trick-or-treating. Green body and black arms and the shape of a witch's hat. Thanks.
Stacey Swanee writes, these were adorable.
Agreed. I liked all four of them, and thanks, Jeff, for donating the story essentially for us to do the bonus episode. I hope folks will go and pick up that book, because those four are a good representation of the other stuff in there. It's all really great. Yeah. It was hard to choose four to do. Mm-hmm. And so, I think that we'll do, you know, with our bonus episodes, we'll do a little more original fiction here and there this coming year. But this month for our bonus, we were talking about maybe just getting on and chatting about how we're doing in our personal lives a little bit. You know, it's been a crazy year.
Yeah, it has.
So we just thought we'd check in with each other, and that's going to be our bonus episode this month. So tune in for that next week. We've got some more sake to finish out the month. That's all we have for our comment show. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
I'm Chris Lackey, and you've been listening to HP Podcraft.
Strange Studies, Strange Stories.
HPPodcraft.com.